The escape rocket on the tip, designed to break free once it reached space, shot off and instantly opened the parachutes that were meant to help it land on re-entry. It played atmospheric tug-of-war with itself for a few moments, burning fuel while its chute prevented any real ascent, then fell into the sea. Post-launch analysis blamed a communication issue between the Atlas rocket, originally configured to carry warheads, and its new satellite cargo. This caused a slight delay in shutoff signals for the engines of the various stages, launching the escape rocket too early. An almost identical issue of structural incompatibility between a Mercury capsule and an Atlas rocket had occurred a few months earlier. These interface failures were breakdowns not of any given component, but of the integration between them. They were the space race equivalent of our task force's blinks, and they arose from a similar lack of information sharing. Originally established as a research organization, NASA was a constellation of teams conducting largely independent work farmed out by administrators. This structure facilitated the innovation capacity of small groups, and many scientists felt comfortable performing experiments in the context of specialized departments akin to those in a university. The interface failures, however, exposed an inherent problem. Independent small groups were very effective at exploratory work, but trouble erupted when the projects of the disparate teams had to be integrated into a vehicle going into orbit. Without fluid integration, nothing would work. The massive forces and tremendous speeds involved in rocket travel led to unpredictable vibrations throughout the whole vehicle, creating systemic issues that transcended the individual fiefdoms of the teams developing the components and the separate disciplines of the structural engineer, the propulsion expert, the electrical engineer, and other team members. There was also electromagnetic interference. Never before had so much digital hardware been crammed so tightly into such a machine, and the signals from different computers often interfered with one another. And then there was gravity. On Earth, dust, fluids, and other contaminants fall to the bottom of vehicles, but in space these elements float freely. If a single floating metal particle happened to touch two adjacent wires simultaneously, a short circuit could cause a system-wide failure. The rocket's computers, body, and electrical systems might have worked perfectly in isolation, but under the interdependent stressors of space travel, they broke down. Given these failures, in 1962, NASA leadership had doubts about the feasibility of Kennedy's goal. Most of us in the space task group thought Kennedy was daft, recalled a NASA executive. I mean, we didn't think we could do it. We didn't refuse to accept the challenge, but God, we didn't know how to do Earth orbit determination, much less project orbits to the moon. Scientists would have to rethink the basic assumptions of engineering. How do you get liquid out of a tank at zero G? One engineer observed. Everybody said, oh, what's so hard about that? You just pressurize it. Pressurize it, my ass. The pressure exerts on everything, and the damn liquid is just floating around. It's liable to be in globs someplace in the tank, and you don't even know where it is in the tank. This is now a fundamental of zero-G. You use a bladder or capillary action. But as the official put it, we didn't know that in 1958 and 59. No one knew whether the lunar surface would be able to support the weight of humans, let alone a spacecraft. They did not know how much radiation would be encountered on the voyage between Earth and the Moon, which had the potential to render the entire project moot. Fuel cell technology, which would become a staple of space travel, had not been heard of in 1960, and these were just the building blocks. This kind of fundamental invention and discovery is usually tackled by small teams and only later expanded at scale. Think of the Wright brothers or Gottlieb Daimler and his partner Wilhelm Maybach, or Alexander Graham Bell and Thomas Watson. But NASA did not have the luxury of starting small. It had to develop and perfect all of these individual technologies simultaneously, like our task force in 2004 and so many other organizations struggling to keep pace today. NASA found itself thrust into a complex environment and would have to find a way to exploit the innovative abilities of a small team at the scale of a large organization. To put a man on the moon, the Apollo program would eventually employ 300,000 individuals working for 20,000 contractors and 200 universities in 80 countries at a cost of $19 billion. The old management model was not built to integrate discovery and development at this scale. As Stephen B. Johnson writes in The Secret of Apollo, the switch from research to development required strict attention to thousands of details. Properly building and integrating thousands of components was not an academic problem, but an organizational issue. NASA would have to link its teams together by disregarding the need-to-know paradigm and widely broadcasting information. In 1963, NASA brought in George Mueller to build the managerial foundation of the Apollo program, and he brought a sea of organizational change. His vision for NASA was that of a single interconnected mind, an emergent intelligence like the joint cognition that defines extraordinary teams. As NASA Director Wernher von Braun framed it, Mueller brought the perspective of an electrical engineer who aspired to create a managerial nervous system, whereas von Braun, a mechanical engineer, saw organizations as reductionist contraptions. Mueller threw out the old org charts and required managers and engineers who were used to operating in the confines of their own silos to communicate daily with their functional counterparts at other field centers and on other teams. Gone were the tidy, Meese-like organizational divisions. As described by Stephen Johnson, this wreaked havoc at NASA headquarters. It converted NASA engineers who monitored specific hardware projects into executive managers responsible for policy, administration, and finance. For several months after the change, headquarters was in turmoil as the staff learned to become executives. People complained about the almost iron-like discipline of organizational communication. Gone were the days when they could attack their own problems in isolation. Von Braun and other senior administrators protested. Previously, NASA headquarters would collect data from field centers each month and have a handful of managers check for inconsistencies. Mueller insisted on daily analyses and quick data exchange. All data were on display in a central control room that had links with automated displays to Apollo field centers. These rooms buzzed with activity, constantly receiving updates from contractors and teams, and in turn providing information to them. It was the Internet before the Internet. Information was updated and shared widely and instantly. As the utility of this information became evident, more and more engineers who were initially opposed started to come around. Administrators built a teleservices network to connect project control rooms with hard copy and computer data and provide the ability to hold teleconferences involving the various laboratories, manufacturing centers, and test sites. NASA engineering talent was temporarily redirected from building rockets to designing an enormous set of radio loops that allowed teams to communicate with one another fluidly. I think we had 250 channels on which people could talk in Complex 39, one official at the Kennedy Space Center recalled. You could tune in to North American 2, and you'd be listening to the guys working the engine. If there was a problem there, you could hear how they were handling the problem. At launch time, every team was put on the same loop. You got instantaneous communication up and down, the official marveled. It was probably one of the biggest loops ever put together. instantaneous communication, instantaneous transmission of knowledge. NASA's approach to outside contractors also changed. NASA had always preferred doing things in-house. The complex interaction of parts meant that subcomponents farmed out to contractors not privy to the full context were likely to create problems when integrated. Von Braun observed, "You cannot simply write a contract on a stage of the Saturn V and let the contractors go." Often, NASA employees would take apart and rebuild everything contractors sent them. But to get a man to the moon, NASA needed expertise and capacity beyond that offered by its own staff. The solution was to bring contractors in-house. In place of a maze of silos and protocols legislating who could know what, Von Braun created two states, in and out. Those who were in had to embrace and understand the Apollo project in its entirety. Specialists continued to do specialized work, but they needed an understanding of the project as a whole, even if establishing that understanding took time away from other duties and was, in some ways, inefficient. NASA leadership understood that when creating an interactive product, confining specialists to a silo was stupid. High-level success depended on low-level inefficiencies. An administrator recounted the collaboration with one contractor. "The reason that it eventually worked and that we got it ready on schedule was because we had everybody in that room that we needed to make a decision. It got to a point where we could identify a problem in the morning, and by the close of business we could solve it, get the money allocated, get the decisions made, and get things working." What Mueller instituted was known as systems engineering or systems management, an approach built on the foundation of systems thinking. This approach, contrary to reductionism, believes that one cannot understand a part of a system without having at least a rudimentary understanding of the whole. It was the organizational manifestation of this insight that imbued NASA with the adaptive, emergent intelligence it needed to put a man on the moon. In the 2 years after Mueller was brought on, Apollo transformed from a group of loosely organized research teams into a tightly run development organization. Even the engineers most ardently opposed to systems management found that many technical problems could be solved only by sharing information. As von Braun put it, "The real mechanism that makes NASA tick is a continuous crossfeed between the right and left side of the house." In half a decade, a space program that had once been a national embarrassment became the best in the world. Launch Tower of Babel. On the other side of the ocean, ELDO had also started out with similarly grand aspirations. Established soon after the European Coal and Steel Community, the predecessor of the EU, it represented unity between countries that had nearly destroyed one another twice in 50 years. The initiative would encourage cooperation between nations, and Western European businesses, governments, and militaries would all gain technical expertise and credibility if the mission succeeded and put objects in orbit. In 1961, European technology and expertise were on par with those of the United States. The Germans had been the first to develop military rockets. The United Kingdom had a successful program of developing air-to-surface, surface-to-air, air-to-air, and ship-to-air weapons. Italy, France, Belgium, and the Netherlands also brought significant resources to bear. But ELDO teams worked independently. Users and manufacturers communicated rarely, and each nation assumed control of a different stage of the rocket. The United Kingdom produced the booster, France the second stage, Germany the third, while Italy made the satellite test vehicle. There was no single location for project documentation, no system for providing access to other groups' documentation, and no specifications for what documentation each entity should produce. Each country managed its part through its own national organization, and each sought to maximize its own economic advantages, which often meant withholding information. Contractors reported only to their national governments. In 1968, NASA's International Programs Chief described the ELDO members' half-hearted and mutually suspicious character of participation. This competitiveness might have been a boon to a less interdependent endeavor, but it was problematic for something as linked and complex as spaceflight. ELDO's first launch failed because it used the wrong kind of bolts to connect the French and German stages. The next collapsed because of differences between connecting rings used by the Germans and Italians. The next attempt, in August 1967, made headway when the second stage successfully separated. But once free of the booster, it did not fire. An electrical ground fault had de-energized a relay in the first stage when the rocket was sitting on the launch pad, and this led to a failure of the second stage sequencer. 4 months later, another electrical interface issue brought down the next launch. In July 1969, a few weeks prior to the American moon launch, an interface error ignited a rocket's self-destruct system while it sat on the launch pad. ELDO's final launch attempt in November 1971 blew up 90 seconds into flight. The organization was dissolved 3 years later. Internal and external analyses later concluded that all these problems stemmed from shortfalls of organizational communication, devastating interface failures, or blinks. In his 1964 book, The American Challenge, French journalist Jean-Jacques Servan-Schreiber argued that Europe's lag behind the United States in the space race was not a question of money, but of methods of organization above all. This is not a matter of brain power in the traditional sense of the term, but of organization, education, and training. On the other side of the pond, Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara concurred that Europe suffered from a managerial deficit. The technological gap was misnamed. It was a space age Tower of Babel. The country's inability to speak to one another obstructed their joint effort to reach the heavens. Like Taylor's World's Fair exhibition in Paris, the success of Apollo 11 and the concurrent shambles of Europa 1 shone a spotlight on the role of management in large-scale endeavors. Congress held hearings to study NASA's managerial secrets. The systems management put in place at NASA became a core process of aerospace research and development, essential to everything from the International Space Station to the Boeing 777. NASA's success illustrated a number of profound organizational insights. Most important, it showed that in a domain characterized by interdependence and unknowns, contextual understanding is key. Whatever efficiency is gained through silos is outweighed by the costs of interface failures. It also proved that the cognitive oneness, the emergent intelligence that we have studied in small teams can be achieved in larger organizations if such organizations are willing to commit to the disciplined, deliberate sharing of information. This runs counter to the standard need-to-know mindset. NASA, at the vanguard of new technologies, was confronting complexity ahead of its time. A half century later, almost every organizational actor has become ensnared in the wayward swirl of complexity. Some of NASA's innovations sound incredibly simple. Take off the blinders and have people talk to each other. The basic concept requires only the unlearning of fundamentalist approaches to efficiency, but the implementation requires constant maintenance. Making sure that everyone has constantly updated, holistic awareness became a full-time job for many and required commitment and time from everyone. In fact, even for NASA, As historian Howard McCurdy has noted, maintaining organizational culture as practiced by the first generation of employees turned out to be most difficult to do. After Apollo, its well-integrated system of units slid into a competitive set of independent entities, its open communications calcified with bureaucracy. One employee characterized NASA in 1988 as the post office and the IRS gone to space. The investigation after the Challenger disaster had especially harsh words for NASA's organizational practices, but the subsequent efficiency-focused program ushered in during the 1990s, called Faster, Better, Cheaper, FBC, took NASA further down the path of carelessness, reducing the inefficient ties that had defined the Apollo approach. One famous interface failure occurred when a communication gap between two working groups resulted in the loss of the $125 million Mars climate orbiter. One system was built for metric measurements, one for imperial measurements. As McCurdy notes, FBC was the antithesis of systems engineering. Systems engineering was formal, elaborate, and expensive. It was inefficient. But it worked. Sets and systems. Systems thinking has been used to understand everything from the functioning of a city to the internal dynamics of a skin cell, and plays a key role in deciphering interdependence. Consider a doctor and her education. Doctors come in many varieties, pediatricians, ENTs, radiologists, etc. Yet while in medical school, all undergo the same rigorous overview of the way the human body works. It doesn't matter if, as a hand surgeon, you spend the rest of your life looking only at palms, wrists, and fingers. Because the human body is not a set of independent elements, but a system of interdependent elements, you need to understand how the metabolism of sugar works in order to understand how diabetes can cause the death of tissue in fingers, just as you need to understand how repeated pressure on the median nerve can lead to carpal tunnel syndrome. When we go under the knife, we want to know that the person holding it has a holistic understanding of the fundamentals of the body, not simply a Taylor-esque instruction card. A checklist is inadequate for surgery because of the quintillions of possibilities that interdependence generates. We would never call the rigors of medical school easy, but it is more feasible to spend 7 years learning about the complex cause and effect relationships in the human body than to attempt to record and memorize every possible event that can befall bodies. This is the difference between education and training. Medical school is education. First aid is training. Education requires fundamental understanding, which can be used to grasp and respond to a nearly infinite variety of threats. Training involves singular actions, which are useful only against anticipated challenges. Education is resilient. Training is robust. Coleman Ruiz talks about BUDS taking individual performance out of the lexicon on day one. This emphasis on group success spurs cooperation and fosters trust and purpose. But people cooperate only if they can see the interdependent reality of their environment. Trainees learn to work together during BUDS surf passage only because they can see that one individual's failure will result in a flipped boat, and if that happens, the whole group will suffer. In our task force, our specialized units had little insight into how their peer teams functioned or how all the pieces fit together. Everyone knew the boat kept flipping, but without a clear view of what everyone else was doing, nobody could see why or how to change it. Like NASA, we needed to promote at the organizational level the kind of knowledge pool that arises within small teams. This was the key to creating a team of teams. We did not want all the teams to become generalists. SEALs are better at what they do than Intel analysts would be, and vice versa. Diverse specialized abilities are essential. We wanted to fuse generalized awareness with specialized expertise. Our entire force needed to share a fundamental, holistic understanding of the operating environment and of our own organization, and we also needed to preserve each team's distinct skill sets. We dubbed this goal, this state of emergent, adaptive organizational intelligence, shared consciousness, and it became the cornerstone of our transformation.
Recap. Like NASA before it, our task force found itself confronted with a complex problem that demanded a systems approach to its solution. Because of the interdependence of the operating environment, both organizations would need members to understand the entire interconnected system, not just individual MISI boxes on the organizational chart. Harnessing the capability of the entire geographically dispersed organization meant information sharing had to achieve levels of transparency entirely new to both organizations. In traditional organizations, this constitutes culture change that does not come easily. It demanded a disciplined effort to create shared consciousness.
Chapter 8. Brains Out of the Footlocker. In July 2004, shortly before the El Amel sewage plant bombing, we had left the battered buildings at Baghdad International Airport and moved our new headquarters to Balad Air Base, 64 miles north of the capital. 20 years earlier, Soviet-built MiG-21s had screeched on and off Balad's tarmac to strafe Iranian troops during the bitter Iran-Iraq war. Later, those same aircraft postured as a threat to General Norman Schwarzkopf's Hail Mary juggernaut into southern Iraq in 1991. Now it was the roar of American jet engines that reverberated off the concrete. The base lay near the lush Tigris River, but in the July heat, its grounds were stark brown. Two runways sliced across the center, flanked on one side by administrative and maintenance buildings, and on the other by a smattering of decrepit concrete shelters. The task force occupied a special high-security compound abutting aircraft taxiways that gave us easy access to planes and helicopters. The compound consisted of prefab trailers, plywood huts, and a hodgepodge of tents clustered in close proximity. Living quarters, workspaces, equipment maintenance, and the mess hall were all nearby. My commute to work was an efficient 40-foot walk. We were given three aging bunkers on the west side of the base, nicknamed Yugos, after the Yugoslavian contractors who had built the hardened hangars to protect Iraqi combat aircraft. Medicine ball-size holes punched through the roofs testified to their failure against the precision weaponry of coalition aircraft during the 2003 invasion. The bunkers were the size of large circus tents, constructed of two thick layers of concrete separated by about a foot of sand. Long, low, arched garage door openings spanned each end. They were beige like the sandstone buildings around the compound and the desert around them. Inside, sound reverberated harshly off the concrete. Our task force picked one as our headquarters and moved in. Although the acres of Iraqi equipment destroyed in the invasion and an eternally smoldering garbage dump presented a depressing picture, for us, Balad was a beautiful opportunity, a place to build something entirely new, the physical manifestation of the organizational system that might tilt the odds in our favor. One of my father's favorite admonitions, applied playfully when I did something dumb, was borrowed from an old sergeant. "Put your brains in your footlocker. I'll do the thinking around here." Our imperative was the opposite. At Balad, we meant to get all the brains out of all the footlockers and working together. We had analyzed the problem, and we knew what needed to change. To become effective against AQI, we would have to dismantle our deeply rooted system of secrecy, clearances, and interforce rivalries, and in its place establish an environment of such transparency that every man and woman in our command understood his or her role within the complex system that represented all of our undertakings. Everyone needed to be intimately familiar with every branch of the organization and personally invested in the outcome. This ran against the grain of the distinct specializations that we had spent the last century developing. Our hope was that, as with BUDS, CRM, and NASA, sharing information would help build relationships, and the two together would kindle a new, coherent, adaptive entity that could win the fight. It was an enormous and risky experiment. At Balad, we set about building the lab. Traditionally, the physical layout of military installations mirrored and supported reductionist efficiency. The Pentagon's unusual shape was originally chosen to fit into a specific piece of land below Arlington Cemetery. And though the project was relocated to avoid desecrating Pierre L'Enfant's grand plan for America's capital, the five-sided design was maintained. It is supposedly possible to move between any two locations in the building in less than 7 minutes. Today, its 17.5 miles of corridors still follow a logical and quickly grasped pattern. But thousands of doors on those corridors are now access protected, a euphemism for locked. Even if your clearance level gains you entry, you may find yourself in a further sub-maze of locked inner doors and access points. Offices are separate and sterile, and despite being in the same building as 28,000 others, people work largely in small, discrete groups, or alone. Built at the start of World War II to pull the military services, previously spread across separate office buildings in Washington, D.C., into cooperative proximity, the building has seen its original intent eroded. It is now a building in which individuals toil independently in accordance with top-down, need-to-know reductionist planning. They might as well be spread around the globe. At our U.S. headquarters at Fort Bragg, a similar physical paradigm prevailed for the first 20 years of the organization's history. Built in the early 1980s with an emphasis on security, the windowless buildings were divided into hallways of small offices, further segmented by cubicles. Few common areas existed to foster social interaction, and strict limitations on outside visitors further separated the task force from other organizations on the sprawling installation at Fort Bragg. In the private sector also, physical space has for a century been used to facilitate and enforce efficiency and specialization. Along with factory assembly lines, the architectural frames of white-collar work have evolved to maximize efficiency. In the 19th century, counting houses, where partners and clerks worked side by side at identical roll-top desks, began to disappear, replaced by subdivided offices. As the volume of clerical and administrative work grew, white-collar professions began importing the reductionist ideal of specialization from the factory floor. Management historian Alfred Chandler observed that the role of the merchant, which once embraced exporter, wholesaler, importer, retailer, shipowner, banker, and insurer, split, like Adam Smith's pin production, into multiple specialized businesses in the late 1800s. Years later, in what Chandler referred to as the managerial revolution, the specialized businesses were reunited when they merged into large, vertically integrated corporations with dozens of departments and hundreds of offices. Many functions were consolidated under centrally managed entities, instead of the sea of small actors responding independently to the forces of the market. Chandler dubbed this force the visible hand, in contrast to Adam Smith's description of market forces as the invisible hand. The number of people working in professional services rose from 750,000 in 1860 to 2.16 million in 1890, and to 4.42 million by 1910. But the number of firms that employed them dropped. 4,000 firms collapsed into 257 combinations between 1897 and 1904. But consolidation did not signal a return to the shared space and understanding of counting house culture. Instead, companies went to greater lengths to preserve stratification. New technologies enabled the construction of larger, taller buildings to house the increasingly complicated strata of the workplace. The office building took shape under the hand of architects such as Lewis Sullivan, who envisioned structures composed of independent, standardized cells, which he likened to the hexagonal building blocks of beehives, discrete, messy units not to be merged. In fact, Sullivan coined the famous phrase, "form follows function," in his 1896 article, "The Tall Office Building Artistically Considered." Dictaphones and pneumatic tubes enabled discrete, directed communications at a distance without the messy inefficiencies of the counting house. Executives moved to separate rooms, then to plush suites, and finally to different floors to separate them from the pools of stenographers toiling away at desks arranged in grids, silent but for the clacking of typewriter keys. The corner office, where a manager could separate himself from the rest of the workforce, became a status symbol. During the 2008 financial crisis, it emerged that many executives commute to their offices in private elevators, further minimizing any potential interaction with employees. It was in the early 1900s that the term ladder became common parlance for the corporate hierarchy. These buildings, the forebears of the Pentagon and the glass slabs that make up today's urban skylines, were designed for the efficient flow of paperwork. This flow was often, quite literally, an assembly line. As a clerical worker explained in 1958, "The girl at the end opens and sorts mail. The next girl is our doer. She does whatever the mail calls for, a cancellation, a receipt, or whatnot. Then I check the papers she hands me and add whatever notations are necessary before I pass them along for copying to the first girl on my left, our team's typist. She, in turn, gives the whole batch to the last girl, our assembler, who puts the papers together in proper order and forwards them, maybe to another department or to central filing, or possibly back to a policyholder." The goal, as in factories, was for processes designed by management to be executed in as efficient and specialized a way as possible. Management theorist R. H. Goodell noticed how visitors passing in a corridor distracted clerical workers. By turning their desks away from the door and facing them toward a blank wall, he could reduce disruption and at the same time play on the uneasy feeling that, at any given moment, their supervisor might be looking over their shoulders. Both increased productivity. How we organize physical space says a lot about how we think people behave. But how people behave is often a byproduct of how we set up physical space. At Ballade, we needed a space that facilitated not the orderly, machine-like flow of paperwork, but the erratic, networked flow of ideas, an architecture designed not for separation, but for the merging of worlds. We weren't the only ones to be trying this. There was a growing movement in the private sector to organize offices for better cooperation, too. Firms that value innovation and creativity have spent a lot of time searching for ways to inject interactivity into work environments. In 1941, Bell Labs famously broke with tradition, hiring Skidmore, Owings, and Merrill to design a campus whose spaces promoted interaction. To move from an office to a lab, for example, employees had to walk through the cafeteria where they would bump into people. The hope was that such casual interactions with peers, managers, and even custodial staff might prompt unexpected insights. In the 1970s, even staid IBM experimented with early non-territorial offices, where engineers could come in, grab their materials, and sit anywhere in the open plan space arranged to facilitate serendipitous encounters with team members. As with NASA, these changes were not initially welcomed, but grew in popularity. "I was skeptical before, but I'd hate to go back to a closed office now," said one engineer. Another was more succinct. "Don't fence me in again." In Silicon Valley, Google, Facebook, and other titans, as well as countless startups, use open plans that put different teams and different rungs of management in the same space. When former Mayor Michael Bloomberg moved into New York's City Hall, he turned down the building's fancy mayoral suites and instead had the Board of Estimate Hearing Room, one of the most lavish ceremonial spaces in the historic landmark, converted into a bullpen. He filled the space with hundreds of cubicles, including one for himself, to maximize the cross-pollination of ideas. He had test-driven this model at Bloomberg LP, the financial and media conglomerate that made him a billionaire. Bloomberg says, "I've always believed that management's ability to influence work habits through edict is limited. Ordering something gets it done, perhaps. When you turn your back, though, employees tend to regress to the same old ways. Physical plant, however, has a much more lasting impact. I issue proclamations telling everyone to work together, but it's the lack of walls that really makes them do it." In the fall of 2008, then Major General Mike Flynn, my intelligence officer in four different assignments, 18th Airborne Corps, the Task Force, the Joint Staff in the Pentagon, and finally at ISAF in Afghanistan, and I visited the Bloomberg bullpen after returning from Iraq. Although we had evolved the task force's physical and cultural ecosystem independently, we were struck by the similarity to what he used to run New York City and what we used to fight a complex war. Bloomberg's hierarchy-flattening, silo-merging bullpen, his sociable workplace bagel bars, and his zero-tolerance policy for executive dining rooms or reserved parking spots were inspired in part by his first employer, the investment bank Salomon Brothers. Anyone could come up to the CEO's desk any time. He was on a first-name basis with as many people at the bottom of the corporate ladder as at the top. This is not just about symbolic egalitarianism. The cultivated chaos of the open office encourages interaction between employees distant from one another on the org chart. Putting himself in the middle of it kept Bloomberg's finger on the pulse of the organization. "If you lock yourself in your office, I don't think you can be a good executive," he says. "It makes absolutely no sense to me." If his own mayoral career has been any measure, he is right. According to Bill Keller, the Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times correspondent, "the great urban contraption that is New York City government has probably never been so well run." The appreciation for serendipitous encounters embodied by Bloomberg's bullpen and Silicon Valley's open plans is a way of saying, We don't know what connections and conversations will prove valuable. At Balad, we attempted something similar. Engineers gutted the inside of the main bunker. We burned the decrepit mess of debris, old partitions, and Soviet-era war materiel that had filled it, and we erected an open-plan plywood endoskeleton. We ran all of our operations out of the Joint Operations Center, JOC, an expansive central space similar to Bloomberg's bullpen. A wall of screens at the front of the space showed live updates of ongoing operations, video feeds of small skirmishes or ongoing raids, JOC log entries recording the outcomes of successful captures or friendly casualties, maps of our gains and losses in different regions of the country. Immediately in front of the screens, we arranged portable tables in a large U-shaped configuration where the task force commander and key leaders all sat, able to see and communicate with one another easily as they worked. Radiating outward were banks of long tables and chairs for the myriad functions of intelligence, air and artillery support, medical evacuation, liaison officers, and all the other capabilities germane to our operations. Anyone in the room, regardless of their position in the org chart's silos and tiers, could glance up at the screens and know instantly about major factors affecting our mission at that moment. Personnel were placed strategically throughout the space, depending on their function. Those with access to real-time information critical to ongoing operations were closer to the center of the room. Those with a longer-term focus were on the fringes, so they could focus on other work. Any of them, however, could walk freely across the room for quick face-to-face coordination. With the touch of a button on the microphone, everyone's attention could be captured simultaneously. We hoped the new architecture would elicit the emergent intelligence we believed resided in the force as a whole and give our teams a comprehensive view of the entire system. It was not enough to know just their own part, or that of one person they bumped into in the cafeteria. In 2004, we had 60 or so people sitting in the space, intelligence analysts, operations officers, military liaisons, intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance, ISR, operators, air power controllers, DOD lawyers, and medical staff. To eliminate one potential excuse for not collaborating, we designated the entire area a top-secret security space. Almost any document or conversation relevant to our operations, many of them very sensitive, could be discussed and debated on the open floor. It was an unprecedented move. Extremely sensitive activities, such as management of intelligence agents and personnel actions within our force, were appropriately conducted in more limited settings. I had a small private office, but rarely used it. Instead, I worked from a space adjacent to the JOC, which we called the Situation Awareness Room, SAR, at the head of another U-shaped table. In this smaller replica of the JOC, I would work alongside my key staff, for example, intelligence, operations, legal, and with the senior representatives in our force from multiple interagency organizations. In the JOC, the focus was Iraq. In the SAR, it was global. Here we created the network to overlay Al-Qaeda's international network. My intelligence director, operations director, and senior enlisted advisor sat beside me and could see and hear everything I did. Learning from the cubicle's failed revolution. Our new physical plant provided structure for our transformation, but we knew it was not enough. A new layout with an old culture can deliver the worst of both worlds. Countless managers eager to adopt the new trend that promises innovation, but reluctant to abandon the org chart, have done away with cubicles only to produce a noisier, more distracting environment that is neither efficient nor effective. The cubicle itself is a good example of management space gone wrong. Originally created by the visionary inventor Robert Probst to free workers from isolation, the cubicle has become a symbol of the impersonal culture it aimed to reform. The Action Office 2 was supposed to be customizable and reconfigurable for privacy, but also for cooperation, promoting interaction. It was designed to be arranged in organic clusters, reflecting a new conception of the office as an interconnected whole. Put into production by Herman Miller in 1967, Probst's invention was immediately perceived as transformative. The New York Post ran an article about it titled, "Revolution Hits the Office," which argued that the days of the completely enclosed boxes in which the bosses isolate themselves behind monster mahogany status symbols and the inhuman row upon rigid row of steel desks with their clumsy drawers at which you sit all day would soon draw to a close. The success of the concept seems assured, the article concluded. Anyone who has set foot in a corporate office in the past 30 years can attest that the product was indeed successful, but the concept of an organic workplace defined by freedom and intellect was not. Instead, managers discovered that they could use the Action Office to squeeze more people into smaller spaces, using the same unforgiving grid that steno pools had featured since the turn of the century. The cubicle's very adaptability allowed it to become, in the rueful words of one Herman Miller employee, the inevitable expression of a concept which views people as links in a corporate system for handling paper, or as input-output organisms whose efficiency has been a matter of nervous concern the past half century. The Action Office is admirable for planners looking for ways of cramming a maximum number of bodies. Today, a staggering 93% of those who work in cubicles say that they would prefer a different workspace. As Probst put it 2 years before his death, reflecting on his greatest legacy, "The dark side of this is that not all organizations are intelligent and progressive. Lots are run by crass people who can take the same equipment and create hellholes. They make little bitty cubicles and stuff people in them. Barren, rat-hole places. I never had any illusions that this is a perfect world." The structure and symbolism of the task force's new, non-hierarchical space was critical. But our organization would not be reborn by just moving furniture around. We needed to renovate our organizational culture as well. Cultures, however, are more resistant to designed change than bricks and mortar. Shared consciousness demanded the adoption of extreme transparency throughout our force and with our partner forces. This was not transparency in the sense that it is usually used in the business world, a synonym for personal candidness. We needed transparency that provided every team with an unobstructed, constantly up-to-date view of the rest of the organization. It is the type of transparency that those of us raised in the comfort of bureaucratic silos find uncomfortable. But it would be absolutely critical to our ability to coalesce and succeed as a team of teams. Some pieces were simple. My command team and I added people to the CC line of emails whenever it seemed that even the second or third order consequence of the operation discussed might impact them. We had to acknowledge that we often could not predict who would and would not benefit from access to certain information. We took almost all phone calls on speakerphone. That included me, the commander in charge of our nation's most sensitive forces. This could make people uncomfortable, sometimes intensely so. But never once in Iraq did I see it hurt us nearly as much as it helped. We were trying to normalize sharing among people used to the opposite. Our standing guidance was, share information until you're afraid it's illegal. the O and I. The most critical element of our transformation, the heart muscle of the organism we sought to create and the pulse by which it would live or die, was our operations and intelligence brief. The O and I, as it was commonly called, is standard military practice, a regular meeting held by the leadership of a given command to integrate everything the command is doing with everything it knows. When I assumed command in 2003, the O and I was a relatively small video teleconference between our rear headquarters at Fort Bragg, a few D.C. offices, and our biggest bases in Iraq and Afghanistan. Quickly, though, that audience grew. We urged everyone from regional embassies to FBI field offices to install secure communications so that they could participate in our discussions. When people think of cutting-edge military hardware, they usually picture weaponry, not a bulked-up version of Skype. But that was our main technological hurdle and point of investment for several months. We knew that forging the neural network that would facilitate our emergent analysis of complex problems was vital for our long-term success, so we designed prepackaged communication bundles that our teams could take into the field, wherever they were in the world. Like NASA, we invested in bandwidth to enable us to reach every component of our force and our partners, from austere bases near the Syrian border to CIA headquarters at Langley, Virginia. Satellite dishes, from small to huge, connected the force. Secure video teleconferences, chat rooms, a web portal, and email became key arteries of our circulatory system. Technically, it was complex. Financially, it was expensive. But we were trying to build a culture of sharing. Any member of the task force and any of the partners we invited could eventually dial in to the O and I securely from their laptops and listen through their headphones. As the scope of the task force's global activities increased and we integrated more players into our network, the O and I became a bona fide institution. The meeting ran 6 days a week and was never canceled. We conducted it by video teleconference at 9 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. This made it a convenient start to the workday for the Washington-based departments and agencies we were trying to integrate ever more tightly into our operations. In Iraq, the meeting kicked off at 4 p.m., giving operators time to rise in the late morning, train, prepare, participate in the O&I, and then get ready for the raids and fights that would take them from dusk until dawn. That synchronized cycle, what we called our battle rhythm, was fueled by the O and I, which pumped information and context throughout our task force. There were real risks in doing this. Opening a top-secret video teleconference to a wide community exposed us to potential leaks. After all, the information we were discussing was secret for a reason. Also, broadcasting unfiltered accounts of our successes and failures risked misinterpretation of complex, in-process endeavors or statements being taken out of context. But I had no interest in, and we had no time for, painting a rosy picture of what was in reality a hellish scene. Anyone who wanted to beat us at a game of bureaucratic politics would have all the ammunition they needed. But that wasn't the fight we were focused on. Pushback. When we set up our new SAR at Balad, we put extra seats at the horseshoe table for the partner agencies that we hoped would come to augment our task force. In the early days, only the CIA liaison's seat was occupied. Intuitively, we knew that if we could generate enough success on the battlefield, others would want to participate. The problem was how to get their participation up front. We needed to bind everybody into a single enterprise, but we had no explicit authority to do so. This was true even for the military forces that made up the operational arm of the task force. Throughout its history, the task force commander has led operators from each